Thank you, Chris, for that introduction. And thank you, Debbie, for the hospitality and inviting me to be here. I'm glad to be here to talk to you today. I walked in and saw a familiar face, so this becomes very easy. If there's anything that I miss or that you don't understand, you have a question, Peggy Putnam is an RN. Not only is she an RN, but she worked in my office and was my nurse for about 5 or 6 years. So she knows this backward and forward. So if you have any question or confusion. So today, the request was a talk on estrogen, which obviously affects all of you here. Well, Matt, we'll let Matt be excused. It affects you throughout your life. Let's see if I can get this. So if you, not only will this be pertinent to you all here, but also for, you know, you have daughters, sisters, granddaughters, so forth. So I hope that we will be able to share with you some things that will enlighten you on what's happening throughout your life. We're going to focus on estrogen, very important to you throughout your life. So let's talk first about what is it, how does it work, where is it produced, and what does it do? Now this is not a chemistry lesson, but I wanted to just show you that estrogen refers to a group of hormones that really are essential for the growth and development of the female sexual characteristics and reproduction. There are three. Estradiol is by far the most important. It's the dominant estrogen. It's the most potent estrogen. Estrone is present mainly at low levels, and of course at menopause, we'll talk later, when estrogen levels fall to a lower level, estrone becomes somewhat important, but still estradiol is the dominant one. Estriol is present during pregnancy, but not so important otherwise. But it's interesting to point out that these are similar. If I showed you a diagram of testosterone, you'd say, gee, it's not very different. It's not very different. It would only have a little thing here, and it would be testosterone. So these things are related. Progesterone would have a little added thing there. So they're related, and when you see, remember from your high school chemistry, when you see this thing, it means that they're in equilibrium. So this one goes back and forth. And when it's going this way, that means it's being metabolized and it's on the way out. So what is a hormone? Now, you're all familiar with hormones. Everybody is familiar, has family members or with diabetes. Well, insulin is a hormone. You know, you have your thyroid gland and it produces a hormone. You have hormones that come from your brain that affect the body. But a hormone is a substance that is sort of a chemical messenger. It's produced in one area of the body, travels through the bloodstream, and has an impact on tissues in other parts of the body. The important concept, the hormones, obviously the hormone is important. It's got to be there for the cell to be instructive what to do. But it has to have a receptor. Without a receptor, the hormone can just pass through and it won't have an impact on that particular cell. Now, estrogen receptors are all over the body. Pretty much every tissue in the body has estrogen receptors, but some cells have many more receptors than other areas. So the hormone's traveling through the bloodstream, gets into the cell. In the case of estrogen, it freely migrates in and out of the cell. If it finds a receptor, or if the receptor finds it, and they combine almost like a puzzle. Once it combines, that combined unit has an impact. So all of you have heard the concept of estrogen receptors with regard to breast cancer. Whether there are receptors there or not has an impact on the treatment of that particular breast cancer. So the receptors are just as important as the hormone itself. We said that there are three different hormones that make up this family of estrogen. where they produce is primarily, primarily in the ovaries. By far, the ovary is the dominant producer of estrogen. It is produced in other areas. Obviously, during pregnancy, the placenta takes over and produces massive amounts of estrogen as well as another hormone called progesterone. So during pregnancy, the placenta is the primary producer. But at other times, it's the ovary. Now, once the ovary stops working, estrogen levels become very low, and there are other things become important so that you have estrogen can be produced in peripheral tissues throughout the body in small amounts. But by far, the ovary is the factory. What impact does it have? Well, obviously, you have male and female. The estrogen, the absence of that Y chromosome, and the estrogen makes you who you are. So it affects things, obviously, the reproductive system, but affects things throughout the body. Well, let's talk about this just a bit. The reproductive system is obviously important. So estrogen, am I standing in the way of you guys? Okay. Estrogen has obviously a huge impact on the reproductive system. I mean, that's really the crux of the issue. But it affects all of these areas. The ovaries, uterus, breast, vagina, cervix, and fallopian tubes, all these organs and tissues need estrogen to develop and function. So that is obviously very vital. And you would expect these areas to have the highest level of estrogen receptors, and so, which is very true. It affects other parts of the body as well. It affects fat storage, where fat is stored, muscle mass, so it makes women shaped more like women as opposed to males. It affects body hair. Estrogen makes body hair fine as opposed to coarse. It affects, typically women will have more dense hair on the their scalp as opposed to males. voice, you know, the vocal cords are different. It affects the structure of the vocal cords, and female voice is different. Bone structure, if an archaeologist finds a skeleton that's a 500 years old, it doesn't take them long to figure out whether it's male or female because the structure is different because of the impact of the estrogen. Bone metabolism, different than the structure. We must think of bones as living organs. They're not just a static, inanimate object. They're actually growing. If a bone were just an inanimate object and it broke, then it would never heal. But it does heal. So the bone substance is growing and being replenished and regenerated constantly. So estrogen helps to increase the balance such that there's more growth than resorption. So that's important for bone strength. Skin, your estrogen has a positive impact on skin, makes it thicker, increases the blood supply, more collagen, so it's just healthier. Heart and liver, estrogen impacts the liver so that it helps the liver produce less of the bad cholesterol, but more of the good cholesterol. So it affects the liver to improve your cholesterol profile so that you have a better cardiovascular status. It also affects the vessels themselves directly, so it makes the vessels healthier, more pliable, so it has a positive, healthy impact on the cardiovascular system. So that's important to know, and we'll talk more about that later about postmenopausal situation. So estrogen is very important. Now the other part of the impact, and this is something maybe most of you are beyond this, but let's talk a little bit about you have daughters and granddaughters, let's talk about the menstrual cycle. And this is something I would like for you to have a better understanding of what's going on here. So this is the ovary and this is the uterus, and let's focus on the lining of the uterus, called the endometrium, but the lining of the uterus. Well, the simple story is that what's happening here is that eggs are produced, they're released, they're picked up by the fallopian tube, their fertilization takes place, and it wanders down, or just transported down into the uterine cavity, implants, and you have a pregnancy. If that doesn't take place, then there's a menstruation, a menstrual period. So that's the basic theme. But let's look at that a little more closely. Okay, as these little dots here represent eggs, or we refer to them as follicles, but let's say eggs for the moment. The brain is involved in making this develop. The brain is sending hormones to the ovary to stimulate the production of these eggs for them to develop. As they develop, this is called a developing follicle. As this egg develops before it's released, this is where estrogen is produced. So when we say the ovaries produce estrogen, what we're referring to is not that the ovary, the stroma, the inner part of the ovary is producing estrogen. Estrogen is being produced by this developing egg. So it's mostly just that developing egg where most of your estrogen is produced. After ovulation, this structure left behind, called the corpus luteum, that exists just for a short while, if pregnancy doesn't occur, also produces estrogen, but it's a continuation of that egg that has developed. So the point is that the estrogen is being produced by these developing follicles. Okay, how many follicles do you have? When you're born, before you're born, you have about 6 million, about 4 months before you're born. By the time of birth, you've actually lost most of those. 75% have already degenerated. And they continually, progressively go away throughout your life, from before the day you were born, all through your life, until menopause, and they're gone. So you start with a lot of them. By puberty, you have about 500,000 left. Only 500 or 600 are going to develop and ovulate during your lifetime. So that's just an interesting fact. You know, where we said estrogen comes from the ovaries, but it's really coming from that developing follicle. Without those follicles, there's no estrogen being produced. Okay, so the egg is being... Well, I've lost my pointer. But as the egg is being developed, it produces estrogen, and the estrogen levels go up, and so the lining of the uterus is responding to that, preparing for pregnancy. When that fertilized egg gets into the uterine cavity, the lining needs to be prepared to accept that for its implant, such that it can provide the nutrients necessary for that pregnancy to grow. Once the egg is released, the remaining structure produces progesterone. Now, progesterone supports the endometrium by making it function well. The estrogen is a growth factor. The progesterone helps it to function, to differentiate so that function produces the nutrients needed for that fertilized egg to progress. Once this egg is released, this will last for about 12 days, so you're producing progesterone for about 12 days. And if fertilization and implantation takes place, the fertilized egg and the developing placental tissue start secreting the pregnancy hormone that we test for to see if you're pregnant. And that hormone feeds back and helps this continue. So the corpus luteum continues on for a few more weeks. If that pregnancy hasn't occurred and that support doesn't take place, this resolves. And once it resolves, the estrogen levels and the progesterone levels fall, and you have a menstrual period. So that lining can't be supported anymore, and so you have a period, and the cycle happens again. So that's important to kind of understand where the estrogen is being produced, how, and the cyclicity of that that function. Now, this is not, I'm not going to spend any time on this, but just to show you that it's kind of a complex cycle for ovulation to occur and for this cyclic event to happen every month. But just briefly, this represents a menstrual cycle. So you have a period, the first day of the period is the first day of the cycle. The egg is being produced, estrogen levels go up, ovulation occurs, the progesterone levels go up. If pregnancy does not occur and there's not implantation, then the corpus luteum regresses and estrogen progesterone levels fall. You have a period and it starts again. So it's complex, and the question is, well, how can this happen every month? Well, it doesn't happen every month. It happens most months, but some months this complex relationship is not going to happen, and so ovulation doesn't necessarily occur every month in a totally predictable fashion. Okay, we've talked about estrogen, what it does, where it comes from, and how it's produced. Let's talk about things that occur during your lifetime related to estrogen. Puberty, it begins, the average time that menstruation begins is about 12. That's, I know everybody thinks that that's getting lower and lower. It's actually been pretty stable the past 50 years. If you look past that to about 150 years ago, it has decreased. But the past 50 years, it's been pretty stable. And just to remind you that most of the time, this occurs on time, rarely occurs before 11, rarely occurs after 14. So if it occurs really early, that's abnormal, needs to be evaluated. If it happens before 10, if it happens after 16, it needs to be evaluated. The process of puberty is complex. It deals with the maturation of areas of the brain, but ultimately it leads to increases in estrogen levels that lead to the changes that we recognize as puberty. Oops, sorry. Other things that occur during the reproductive years. Estrogen in the reproductive years is commonly impacts your life as a medication. Birth control pills have become a prominent part of your life. So let's spend a minute on birth control pills. I'm not many of you here are in need of birth control pills, but you need to have some understanding of them. Birth control pills obviously work by suppressing ovulation, but there are other benefits. So I think it's important to kind of understand that the ovulation is actually suppressed. Birth control pills have two components. We talked about progesterone, but there's an estrogen and a progesterone. It's the progesterone that inhibits ovulation mostly. The estrogen works by stabilizing the lining of the uterus so that during this time you don't have irregular bleeding. So the estrogen kind of functions to help stabilize the situation as far as menstrual bleeding, whereas the progesterone is really inhibiting ovulation. And we have contraceptive methods that are progestin only that inhibit ovulation that work very well. I want to, a big point here is to notice that there are other benefits of oral contraceptive pills. And in my practice, this is comes up as much as the contraceptive part of it. The regulation of the menstrual cycle reduces the cramping associated with the menstrual cycle, reduces bleeding, And it also reduces the follicles' overgrowth and the formation of ovarian cysts. So we have many patients who benefit from a birth control pill, not just from the contraceptive value, but from the other benefits of the pill. Now, there are risks to taking a birth control pill. Fortunately, these risks are small, but it is important to recognize that there are risks. Let's look at pregnancy. Obviously, estrogen has a role in pregnancy. We mentioned earlier that during pregnancy, it's the placenta that produces most of the estrogen, produces massive amounts of estrogen and progesterone. The estrogen is important to stimulate the uterus, placenta, and the breast and the mother's circulatory system. Your blood volume doubles during pregnancy, so the circulatory system has to grow. Progesterone, we mentioned as the other hormone that's important in this area, especially during pregnancy. It's called the hormone of pregnancy. Serves to relax the smooth muscle of the uterus, relax other smooth muscles in the body, which causes some havoc during pregnancy with regard to relaxation of the GI tract, so that you have trouble with slowing the GI tract and constipation. Varicose veins, relaxing the smooth muscle around the vascular system, so you have some vein dilatation. Varicose veins relaxes the smooth muscle in the stomach, so you have reflux during pregnancy. So it causes some problems, but it's very important to allow the pregnancy to continue. In fact, interestingly, we never use estrogen as a support during pregnancy, but we sometimes, there are situations where we do add progesterone for certain problems during pregnancy. During the reproductive years, the menstrual period has an impact. For some it can be pretty routine, but for others there are problems. The problems are irregular periods. I talked about the ovulation cycle and the fact that it's kind of complicated to have that cyclic function occur on a regular basis. And for some, it doesn't occur regularly at all. So 5 to 10% of women really have very few predictable regular periods. And they have kind of anovulatory, or they don't ovulate regularly throughout their life. So irregular periods can be a problem, and often we use birth control pills to regulate that. Obviously, the heaviness of the period can be a problem and interfere with one's quality of life. Sometimes this is just heavy, not because there's a problem, it's just a variation on the theme. If it's to a point that it's interfering with quality of life, it needs to be addressed. There are things that pathological things that can interfere as well. Fibroids or myomas or little growths, nodular growths within the wall of the uterus, and that can interfere with the function of the uterus, sometimes causing heavy, painful periods. Adenomyosis is a condition in which you have the lining of the uterus growing into the wall of the uterus, causing heavy, painful periods. Painful periods we just kind of talked about. Adenomyosis, endometriosis, painful periods, endometriosis. Is a situation where the lining cells inside the uterus travel through the fallopian tube and implant in areas on the ovary or outside the uterus, and that can cause discomfort and pain and inflammation, so that you have painful periods, or the common presenting feature of that. So we've talked about the reproductive age time. And the problems that can occur and the issues occurring there. Now let's move to the menopause time. Menopause has become very important. Why? Because we're living longer. You know, if you look at the life expectancy before 1900, not many people lived to the menopausal years. Some, but not very many. Since 1900, our life expectancy has gone up. So for women now, it's above 80, 82, 83. So you're spending, the average woman will spend a third of her life in the postmenopausal time frame. What is menopause? Well, it's really the cessation of ovarian function. Why does ovarian function end? We talked about that earlier. When the follicles that are in the ovary from before you were born, that are regressing to some degree, a percentage, or regressing every day, whether you're pregnant, on birth control pills, whatever, there's a progressive loss of these follicles throughout. When all of them are gone, remember we said that that's where the estrogen is being produced by that developing follicle. If there are no follicles, there's no the estrogen production pretty much goes to zero. So now, if you have a hysterectomy, technically menopause refers to the word is the last period. Well, if you've had a hysterectomy, the last period has occurred, but your ovaries are still functioning. So from one perspective, you say, well, they've had their last period, so are they postmenopausal? And the answer is no. So we consider menopause really, in a medical view, related to the function of the ovary. So if you've had a hysterectomy, the ovary may continue to function, but when that function stops, then that is the definition of menopause. It's a transition. It doesn't happen in just one day. So it's a transition, usually taking 2 to 5 years. During that transition, as you get to that age of menopause, the average age of the last period is age 50. When you get to that transitional period, it's important to know that ovulation can occur sporadically. It's not easy to get pregnant when you're 50, but it can happen. The oldest person to spontaneously conceive is someone at age 57. That's very, very rare, but it's important to kind of be aware of that. And that kind of relates to what I just said. The transitional period is 2 to 8 years. Usually starts around age 30. Average age it starts is 46. It's over by 50-51 or so. The range for menopause, the normal range, is 40 to 56. So if you look at the two standard deviation bell curve, we consider it normal to have menopause at any time after 40, but it can be up to 56, can be in the normal range. When you go through menopause, the ovary, the follicles are gone, ovarian estrogen production has gone to near zero. So your estrogen levels are down. Now, it's not down to zero, because we said earlier that estrogen is also produced in other tissues throughout the body. So you do have estrogen production beyond menopause. But it's a much lower level than what was being produced by the ovary. So when that estrogen level falls, you may have symptoms. You may not, but you may have symptoms. Half of women go through menopause with very little symptomatology, and half do. On one end of the spectrum are women that have significant symptoms. I mean, really symptoms to a degree that it strongly affects their quality of life. And on the other end of the spectrum is someone that goes through menopause without a single symptom. They really don't understand each other. So when you talk to your friends about your menopausal transition, you be aware that there's a big spectrum. And if you're on one end of the spectrum or the other, you may not understand what's going on with your person you're discussing it with. The common things that we see from this lower estrogen levels, this withdrawal from estrogen, hot flashes and night sweats, which are physiologic, measurable events. It's not something that's just occurring and you're thinking this is happening. There are measurable changes. You can measure skin changes, the EEGs, and see changes in the brain. So there are measurable changes that occur. It's a real thing. These things can interfere with sleep. There are mood changes. probably these things may be all related to the hot flashes. When a patient is hooked up to the various monitors, such that they're trying to measure the hot flash, they can see that they can have a hot flash that the individual may not be aware of. So it's measured, but the person can't really sense that it's happening. So during sleep, that can occur, interfere with the quality of sleep, interfere with REM sleep and the quality of sleep, even though the person doesn't wake up and doesn't know where they're having hot flashes. Of course, there are others that are very aware during the night that they're having a hot flash, they're sweating, and so their sleep is interrupted, and they know it's been interrupted. So it doesn't happen to everyone. Half of women do not have that problem, but if you interfere with sleep, especially I've noticed as I get older, sleep is very important. And if you interfere with sleep, the next day, you notice that. If it happens nine after nine after nine after night, it's going to have an impact. So I think some of the mood changes, fatigue, some of the things that you are noted, perhaps are all related to the changes in hot flashes and night sweats. Atrophic changes. Estrogen, we talked about the estrogen receptors, and especially in the reproductive system, they're very dense. So if you lower estrogen levels, you're going to have an impact on those tissues. So for instance, in the vaginal atrophy, there are changes. The estrogen levels drop, the vaginal tissues change. This may or may not cause problems, but in half of women it does. So it can cause problems with vaginal dryness or difficulty with intercourse. So this becomes an issue for many women. So when we talked earlier about estrogen, it seemed like all I said was good things about estrogen. And obviously, it does all good things throughout your life. When it goes away, there are problems. So it seems like it would be obvious that when you go through menopause, that you take estrogen to prevent these problems. Well, it's not quite that simple, but there are benefits to taking hormones after menopause. The benefits reduces the uncomfortable symptoms related to menopause, prevents and reverses some of the atrophic changes, improves sleep through the mechanism that we discussed, reduces osteoporosis. You know, osteoporosis being a very significant problem. I alluded to it earlier, saying that estrogen has a big impact on bone metabolism throughout your life, making bones stronger. So when you lose that estrogen, when it drops so significantly at menopause, that bone metabolism will change, and you lose bone strength. So osteoporosis, your bones get thinner, and now that we're living longer, it becomes a big issue. So half of women will suffer an osteoporotic-related fracture during their lifetime. So it's a big, big problem. So this having a medication, and there are other medications that help with osteoporosis and treatment as well, but its impact on osteoporosis should be looked at as very significant. Cardiovascular protective benefit of taking hormones. Well, we talked about estrogen being protective of the cardiovascular system earlier. Well, it data shows that it does protect it after menopause. The caveat is that it only is protective if the cardiovascular system is healthy to begin with. So if you have an unhealthy cardiovascular system, estrogen is not going to reverse that, is not going to help it, in fact, may have harmful effects. So that's been demonstrated with careful monkey studies, in which you take, monkeys do not go through menopause, but you can remove their ovaries, and researchers have done this, and then looked at postmenopausal monkeys with estrogen replacement, non-estrogen replacement on a high fat diet, and then looking at their vessels later. And they showed that if the estrogen started soon after the ovaries are removed, it protects. if you allow the vessels to get atherosclerotic, then the estrogen does not help. So that principle is becoming more and more apparent, I think, that there's protection if the timing is good. Not to say that it's going to protect you and allow you to live to be 120, but there's probably some protection. So all that's good, and there's possible, there's some data that would suggest that estrogen replacement started early after menopause, there may be some benefit to reduction in dementia. That's still somewhat controversial, but it looks like that is on the same theme, that there's a timing issue. If it started early, there's some protection. If it started late, there's no protection. In fact, it could be harmful. Everything is not all good. If you're taking estrogen after menopause, there are risks. There's a risk of breast cancer if you take a hormone replacement after menopause. Blood clots, thrombosis, blood clots in your legs that can travel to your lungs. Stroke, meaning atherosclerotic and vascular changes in the brain. So there's an increased risk of stroke. And some other heart-related issues. Now, some of this seems like this is counter each other, but I think the counter is, to a large degree, you have to keep in mind patient selection and the timing. If you start the hormone replacement early after menopause, there are probably some benefits with regard to the cardiovascular system. If you wait till 65 or 70, those benefits probably will not occur. If someone, now everyone's not healthy at age 50. So if you have someone that already has cardiovascular disease, they've had a heart attack, they've had a stent, that's not a person to use hormone replacement. The other issue, I'll talk about a little more in a second, it depends on how you're taking the hormone replacement. Hormone replacement, the estrogen is the beneficial component of hormone replacement. If you have, in the woman that has not had a hysterectomy, taking estrogen only can increase her risk of uterine cancer. So it's important for her, if she's going to take hormone replacement, to take a progesterone to counter that harmful effect. In those women taking both estrogen and progesterone, there's a slight increased risk of breast cancer from taking that combination. If you've had a hysterectomy, you don't need the progesterone. So take estrogen only. And in that group, studies indicate that there's not an increased risk of breast cancer. So that's an important distinction. So you have to kind of weigh that in who you are, what your situation, as in making a decision whether you want to use hormones after menopause. Okay, in women who are considering hormone replacement, at the proper time, there are different ways of taking it. And let's talk about that for just a second. We talked about in the women who've had a hysterectomy, they do not need any progesterone to protect the uterus. The uterus is not there. So they can take estrogen only. They have a little bit of a benefit, advantage. So you take estrogen only, and the benefit is that, as we discussed, we don't feel like there's any increased risk of breast cancer in that format. Now, you can take estrogen by orally, by tablet, or you can take it transdermally by a patch or a gel. The difference is there is a distinction in how that's in the metabolism and pharmacology of that. If you take it by mouth, everything we take by mouth goes through our GI tract and goes to the portal vein to the liver. So the blood supply from the GI tract goes through the liver and then back into our cardiovascular system. So any medication you take by mouth goes to the liver first. Transdermally, that doesn't happen. It's absorbed into your vascular system, and it eventually goes to the liver, but not in a concentrated format. So the impact on the liver is different. The impact of estrogen on, as far as increasing blood clots and stroke, is primarily changing the products that are produced by the liver. So by the transdermal approach lowers that impact. So studies would indicate that taking the estrogen transdermally reduces the risk of blood clots and the stroke risk. So that's a big distinction, a big advantage. So if someone, I encourage my patients, if they've had a hysterectomy and they have symptoms such that they wish to take hormones, I encourage them to consider try the transdermal approach. There's a cost difference, granted, but I think it's something that should be looked at. So you have not had a hysterectomy, you're going to take estrogen plus progesterone. Now, the estrogen you're going to take continuously, but the progesterone can be taken two ways, either continuously or in a cyclic fashion. 30 years ago, we gave everyone hormone replacement, cyclic hormones, but that may lead to continuation of having a menstrual period. So patients generally prefer the format in which they can avoid menstrual bleeding. So taking the medications continuously allows most women to take the medication without a period. A newer format, a new drug called Duavie, is a combination of an estrogen with a product that protects the uterus. So if you have not had a hysterectomy and you're taking the estrogen, you want a medication to protect the uterus. So it uses a different medication that is not a hormone, is not a progesterone. It's called a selective estrogen receptor modulator, meaning it will impact certain estrogen receptors, but not others. So this medication and this particular product protects the uterus by impacting those receptors, but doesn't increase the risk of uterine cancer. So but it's not a hormone. So it allows the person who's not had a hysterectomy to take a medication that's basically estrogen only, without the progesterone, meaning that there should be a decreased risk of breast cancer. So that has become an important mainstay since it's been available the past few years. So that's important to talk to your doctor about those different ways of taking the hormone replacement if you're taking that. The present thought, we talked about benefits and risk. Because of those risks, the present thought is that we lean towards taking hormone replacement after menopause only if there's benefit. In other words, if you go through, which I said that there's a spectrum, and many of my patients will go through menopause and really not have significant symptoms. If you're not having symptoms, then the benefit of taking estrogen is there's cardiovascular benefit and there is bone benefit, but you can do other things for those benefits. So the current thought is that if you're not having a lot of symptoms, then probably lean towards not taking hormone replacement. If you're having symptoms, then you need to look at what to take, how to take it, and so forth. Does that make sense? So as far as how long do you take it, similar thing. If someone, say a patient is very symptomatic as they go through the transition to menopause, very symptomatic, very uncomfortable, so we, in that case, I would strongly encourage the patient to take a medication that will relieve those symptoms. So they use the medication. Generally, over 3 to 5 years, those symptoms will go away. So we do trials off the medication as time goes along, and hopefully they'll be off the hormone replacement 3 to 5 years. Now, about 20% of women will have symptoms lifelong, and they will take their hormone replacement throughout their life. So I have patients in their 80s that are taking their hormones and you could not talk them into not taking them because there's benefit, they've been taken. And so there are those that will benefit really for forever. So the main thing to understand is that there's a spectrum, a big spectrum, and you can't just say, well, what am I supposed to do based on your age? You have to look at your individual health and your symptomatology and decide if it's good for you. And your doctor will help you make that decision. There are some other questions that came up, and the things I got from Debbie. I think I'll just leave those for if anybody has any specific question. And I wanted to say we have a website in our practice that's open to everyone. You don't have to be a patient of our practice to use our website. I'm not sure if I can. Thank you for your attention.